On this week's episode of Video Culture, we'll talk blood and greed in the 80s with Wall Street and American Psycho. Excuse me, I have to go return some videotapes.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome to another episode of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And this week's episode is Blood and Greed in the 1980s with Wall Street and American Psycho.
We're talking about two movies that really plunge into the really narcissistic, superficial 1980s culture.
Yeah, like the just over abundance, just like, how did I explain it before? Like the just consumer culture, like of everything. In the 1980s, and really, I think we had the idea of doing this episode as just like greed, and so we kind of came up with Wall Street, and then we kind of came up with American Psycho, because it also involves, you know, a sort of Wall Street, you know, corporate type. Although the storyline is completely different from Wall Street.
Yeah, but stylistically, there's some real similarities there, and they definitely kind of poke holes in the idea of the successful 80s businessman. So mm-hmm. I think there's enough overlap there to make them interesting to kind of compare, you know?
Yeah, it's two different sort of takes on that excess of the 80s, I guess you would say. And one, we'll just get into Wall Street, is more focused on, you know, like the Wall Street moguls of the ones that were really sort of taking advantage of, you know, companies and really trying to take, you know, a piece of the pie, you know, as mergers and acquisitions happened and you know, companies got bought out and you know, you wind up with stock trader tips and you wind up with, you know, this money without really, you know, doing anything except for sort of manipulating everything, which I find, you know, very sort of interesting. But this is, you know, this is how our sort of business culture is run. And, you know, a very popular movie in the 80s starring Michael Douglas and Charlie Sheen and Daryl Hannah and Martin Sheen. It was directed by Oliver Stone. Written and directed by, or co-written by Oliver Stone.
And I've also got to mention, it's got some other great people in it. It's got James Spader in it and Hal Holbrook. It's got a really good cast.
Yeah. And even John C. McGinley.
How could I forget John C. McGinley as Charlie Sheen's fellow stockbroker?
Yeah.
It seems like he never ages. He's like perpetually the same.
Yeah, exactly. He's always kind of like in his you know, 30s or 40, you know, yeah, just, and always playing that kind of slightly jerky, you know, loudmouth, you know, kind of guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
one you don't really,
humor, yeah.
Yeah, kind of sleazy, one you kind of don't want to hang around all the time. But yeah, and then also Sean Young as well.
That's true, yeah. I actually forgot Sean Young was in it, but yeah.
But anyway, I'll just go through the quick synopsis. And sure. On the Wall Street of the 1980s, Bud Fox, who's played by Charlie Sheen, is a stockbroker full of ambition, doing whatever he can to make his way to the top. admiring the power of the unsparing corporate raider Gordon Gekko, who is played by Michael Douglas, Fox entices Gekko into mentoring him by providing insider trading. As Fox becomes embroiled in greed and underhanded schemes, his decisions eventually threaten the livelihood of his scrupulous father, who's played by his actual father, Martin Sheen. Faced with this dilemma, Fox questions his loyalties. So it's that classic case of, you know, how far down the rabbit hole are you going to go? Like, how are you going to step off the edge and, you know, do kind of like what it takes? Like, everybody kind of does this to get ahead. Is this like sort of innocent guy who's, you know, having to cold call, you know, clients to try to, you know, get them invest in some, you know, bond or, you know, something like, he's really trying to, you know,
he's basically trying to nickel and dime his way to being successful. And exactly. by selling, you know, very low end stock. And
well, that's right, the way a lot of corporate traders begin. They begin like this. Like, I remember watching like The Pursuit of Happiness starring Will Smith. And, you know, it explained, like, that movie to me, like, really deeply explained what it is like to be sort of like this, you know, trader person who's out there trying, you know, this broker trying to get people to buy stock. You know, and that's all they do. It's just like work the phones, try to call people, trying to get them invest in whatever junk stock they got going that day.
Yeah, basically they're trying to sell the idea of potential. That's really all they're selling, mm-hmm. is the idea that it might be worth something eventually.
Yeah, buy low, right. Sell high. This company's hot. You know, we got a tip that they're, you know, on the growth path, that sort of thing.
But you're right, Wall Street is very much a morality play. It's really kind of the angel and devil story. In this story, really, the angels on Bud Fox's shoulder, Charlie Sheen's shoulder, are really his father and Hal Holbrook's kind of established trader at his firm.
Right.
But the devil is really almost, obviously, so it's almost, the movie almost beats you over the head with it, is really Gordon Gekko and Michael Douglas's character. I mean, in a lot of ways, Gordon Gekko maybe kind of looks like our kind of modern idea of what like a devil character looks like. He's got like slick back hair, nice suits, always smoking.
Yeah,
you know, he just seems the big sinister.
Yeah, this big executive office that you can't get an appointment with. He's always meeting with executives. He's always yelling at people on the phone to do something. Like, got one phone, you know, talking to one guy and, you know, on the phone and talking to another guy in the room at the same time.
Yeah, it's really an iconic performance from Michael Douglas, who, he's larger than life in the film, and it's a really striking character that he portrays in the film, but the morality play of it really very quickly turns to almost a story of how easy it is to be corrupted, because there's not a lot of back and forth on will Charlie Sheen's character be good or bad. He very quickly falls to the dark side, so to speak, and starts doing basically corporate espionage for Gordon Gekko, and it becomes like almost like a spy movie for a little bit, where he's tailing people and trying to sneak around.
Well, I mean, it's all you know. There's SEC, you know, the Security and Exchange Commission. Guidelines on insider trading, right?
Where it's highly illegal.
Yeah, highly illegal. So if like even like, you know, in the movie, you know, Charlie Sheen kind of uses some insider information from his father, who works as a mechanic on the airlines, that they're, you know, about to get a favorable, federal decision on a case, which is going to, you know, help them leverage, bank loans so that they can, you know, have some growth. And so that's basically like kind of the idea of insider trading. Like if somebody knows something from the inside, then, you know, they're free to, you know, use that information. But, you know, you're not supposed to, basically, you know, do that kind of stuff. Like if, you know, there were tales of this, you know, during the, COVID-19 scare, some congressmen basically started divesting in certain things because they knew that the, you know, economy was going to take a hit. It's that sort of thing. And it's very sort of, you know, there are clear rules. And basically that's what, you know, Michael Douglas is like, look, man, you either play it or you don't. If you're going to play it honest, like, you can go back to the phones and, you know, work the phones and, you know, basically go the Hal Holbrook way, you know, the Lou Mannheim, like, bootstraps, or do you want to, you know, do you want the quick way? Do you want the quick way out? Do you want, and, well, you know, it's like, you got to play the game. So it's not just like, hey, what do you read in the trades, or what are you looking in the analyst, or what are you looking in the numbers? He said, you can look at the numbers for death. What you need is information. So there's a pivotal moment where, you know, Bud Fox's character has to decide which way to go.
Yeah, but the movie really it gets to that point pretty quickly, and then it's more about his fall and his redemption at the end of the film is pretty short too. I mean, a lot of the movie is really just him kind of falling and kind of wallowing in this world of corporate greed.
Right. Like, yeah, I mean, because you know, yeah, Michael Douglas, you know, his character Gordon Gekko, like, really takes him under his wing and, like, shows him, like, this is what y'all you can have. Like, you know, just extravagantly, you know, gives him a bunch of kickbacks, basically, which is also, like, highly illegal, you know, for, you know, in the SEC.
So, but yeah, so much of the movie really is just kind of a damning of this, of this greed above all culture. You can tell that Oliver Stone feels very strongly against the corporate trader world. I mean, it's not a very positive portrayal, no matter what. Either they're all saps or they're all crooked, basically. And that's really how the entire movie looks at it. I mean, really, the only really decent person to look up to in the end is Martin Sheen's character, who is just kind of a working stiff.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's following the example of his, like, blue collar father, who is like, you know what, you know, you have to do good. You know what I mean? Like, it's not just about the amount of money that you have in your wallet. You know what I mean? You judge a man's character by what he does, not how much money he has.
You bring up that scene in the elevator where he says that. Yeah. But that's the thing that always cracks me up. For some reason, he says, you judge a man by his character, not by the size of his wallet. And he shouts the word wallet.
Yeah.
And for some reason, that cracked me up. It's just this little choice piece of overacting for Martin Sheen.
Right.
It just tickled me.
Well, that's what you really have. You really have, like, Martin Sheen versus, like, Michael Douglas, because you have, you know, don't judge, like, that's the quote, right? Don't judge a man, you know, by the size of his wallet or whatever the quote was. And then versus Michael Douglas' character, Gordon Gekko, is greed, for a lack of a better word, is good. You know? I mean, that's his whole, you know, motivation, basically.
And what's really kind of sad was the movie was meant to be kind of damning that whole culture, but really all it did was inspire a lot of people to go down that path. There's a whole culture of people who really saw Gekko as a heroic character. It's like the kids who misunderstand Scarface, you know?
Right.
They think Tony Montana is like this kingpin. They don't get that, well, you know, in the end, he falls.
Yeah, and I think it's because, well, you don't really see, you know, you kind of have the idea that his character goes down, but you don't really get to see it. But and I don't want to spoil it because for several reasons. But you know, good. I mean, obviously, good here because it's written by Oliver Stone is gonna, you know, sort of prevail. It doesn't prevail in the way that you would want to. It still leaves you kind of feeling dirty and feeling bad for, you know, for everyone. My point that I was trying to make is that, where was I going with that? I can't remember. When you say, like, people were kind of foiled by it. I think it's because there's one line in the movie where, Bud Fox, you know, he catches, Gordon Gekko. He kind of gets double crossed and he kind of feels betrayed by Gekko. And he's like, hey, you went against me. And he's like, and then he asks him straight out. He says, how much money is enough? And he says, it's not just about how much I have. It's how much, you know, if it's not me, it's somebody else.
Yeah.
And that's the whole motivation. And that's where you finally like get like where these guys are coming from. It's not just like, okay, yeah, we're living great. Like I can go to France whenever I want, or I can go to the coast, or I can do all these things and have five houses. It's like, I have to keep being on top to be on top.
Yeah, it's almost a competitive game. It's like another version of like alpha male syndrome, which is kind of sad that that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, lives are manipulated for the idea of ego and gamesmanship.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you, Ryan.
Yeah.
What did you think of Wall Street? Just, you know, did you like it? Did you not like it?
I loved it. I thought that you know, of the other movies that I've seen that have kind of, you know, hit it around it. Like, we saw some of this in, like, Working Girl, right?
Yeah.
You see some of this in, like, Secret to My Success. But never do you get really, like, the sort of sinister side of Wall Street, where it's not just like, oh, we're going to manipulate people kind of like the way that it does in Working Girl, where you really get to see, like, the dirty side, right? You really get to see, yeah, like, how the sausage is made, sort of. And it really makes you kind of like sick at your stomach that like these are the decisions, these are how these decisions are made for companies that like, you know, get bought out or get sold or like, you know, this or that or the other. And
this is how people actually get that wealthy,
right?
And it's ugly.
It's because it affects so many people. It's because when these companies are bought and sold, it affects thousands and thousands of people, you know, whether they have a job the next day or not, or whether we're going to have, you know, another company is going to have another company to compete against. You know, it really affects a lot of things.
Yeah. I tell you, I did enjoy it. I realized after when I watched it, I'd only ever seen parts of it on HBO growing up. I thought I had seen the whole thing all the way through. But watching it back this time, I realized I hadn't. And I was really taken by just how iconic Gordon Gekko is as a character. Like, I kind of understand why he became like this 80s excess icon.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a very compelling performance. But, you know, Martin Sheen's really great in it, too. I mean, he's really great as like this decent everyman.
Yeah, I really thought it was funny because I thought Charlie Sheen is who we follow. You know, Bud Fox is who we see the eyes of everything through, right? But really who steals the show is Michael Douglas and Martin Sheen.
Yeah.
You know?
Really, I mean, Charlie Sheen's good in it, but he really gets acted off the screen by both of them.
Yeah.
He really does. I mean,
yeah.
And but I did enjoy it. I felt it, some of it was almost a little too dated for me. I know we need to have to try to watch movies in their time period.
Yeah.
But some of it felt just a little too dated for me. Mm-hmm. It seemed pretty fascinated by the way the trading worked and like the technology of the trading.
Yeah.
And seeing it now, you know, 30 years later,
yeah,
it just seems quaint.
Mm-hmm.
So that part didn't quite work for me. And the way it ended with the big V end at the end, I thought, well, that's a choice.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I think, like I said, I think the only thing that I can think is that Oliver Stone didn't want to make you, even though that it had a good ending, it isn't, the best ending, and it still is an ending that leaves you satisfied.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm hungry, so I'm going to eat a salad. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like,
yeah,
that's filling, but I don't know.
Yeah. Like I said, just stylistically, that the it's completely from an aesthetic point of view, that the end was just like, huh,
mm-hmm,
that's an odd way to, why not just fade to black?
Yeah.
And have like directed by Oliver Stone. But anyway, to move it along.
Yeah, well, both these movies ended oddly, which we'll get to in a second. But yeah. But yeah, that was a choice. Was there scenes that you wanted to fast forward?
I was about to ask you to go to the fast forward rewind part of the show. Yeah. For this movie. Are there any scenes that you would want to fast forward through in Wall Street?
Every scene with Daryl Hannah.
He's not good in this.
I mean, the scene where they're like at, I mean, not really every scene. I mean, the scenes where they were like in the apartment together and stuff like that and kind of being a couple, that was, you know, that was fine. I didn't really find any problems with that. The problems that I did have, the whole beginning scene of the setup scene where, you know, Charlie Sheen, where Bud Fox goes over to Gordon Gekko's house and there's like a party going on. That whole like setup before the other guy, you know, shows up.
Oh yeah, and Terrence Stamp, who we didn't even bring up that Zod's in this movie. Yeah.
Sir Larry Wildman. Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
He also plays like a really good like sort of villain in this you know, sort of character too. And yeah, everything before he shows up, just awful. Just I could deal without it. You really don't even need it. It really doesn't even mean anything in the movie.
Yeah, and some of the 80s style really is jarring to me. But anyway, so that's what you would skip over. What scenes would you savor about? What would you rewind and watch again from Wall Street?
I think the whole scene where Martin Sheen or Michael Douglas, well, two scenes really. Where Michael Douglas is on the beach, like calling him from the cell phone. I mean, that's just like iconic and. I love it. And then also the, you know, like you mentioned it before, the scene with Martin Sheen, like in the elevator, and that whole, you know, sort of, dialogue between, you know, Charlie Sheen and Martin Sheen, you can definitely tell, I mean, obviously it's real father and son, but they had such a chemistry, you know, between them and to stay in character like that and what they were saying and just the way they kept it going was really good. I found it very fascinating.
Yeah, you can feel the connection there. That's the interesting thing about having a father and son play a father and son on screen.
And you can really, feel
the connection between them.
Yeah, and you can really feel the tension, you know.
Yeah, and I would agree with your choices. I would think the beach scene with Gekko is one of the few scenes where he actually feels like he's not fronting. He's being a little open in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the few times in the entire film where he's not conning someone or playing towards the game. He's just himself, and I like that moment in the film. It's one of the few moments where it's not, you know, about the pursuit of money or the greed or trying to conquer something. He's just existing in a space.
Right. And he's telling Bud Fox to, you know, enjoy the fruits of your labor, basically, you know, like savor it.
Yeah.
You know,
like he's for once Gecko's being human.
Right.
I actually agree with both your choices and I think those would be mine as well.
All right. All right, so moving on to American Psycho. This movie came out in 2000.
It did, 20 years ago.
20 years ago. Directed by Mary Harron, who also directed I Shot Andy Warhol and the notorious Betty Page. She also is a co-writer of the screenplay. American Psycho is based on the book of the same name written by Bret Easton Ellis in 1991.
Yeah, he wrote The Rules of Attraction as well, and a lot of other books. But yeah, the novel is very controversial. I've never read it, but it sparked a lot of controversy when it came out, and as the film was going into production. But let's hear what IMDb says about what the whole thing's about.
So, Patrick Bateman, who is played by Christian Bale, is handsome, well-educated, and intelligent. He is 27, living on his own American dream. He works by day on Wall Street, earning a fortune to complement the I haven't read this out loud, so I apologize.
It's okay.
Earning a fortune to complement the one he was born with. At night, he descends into madness as he experiments with fear and violence. That's a very broad stroke description.
It is, because the movie's kind of hard, because let's get into that. I mean, the movie kind of sets it up as, like, let's be honest, Patrick Bateman is a serial killer.
Right.
Where he basically is a Wall Street guy by day, where he works in So I mean, he has some vague corporate job where he's a, vice president, you know, and but he doesn't actually ever do any work. But at night, he tends to hurt people.
You can't really say that because there is some ambiguity, and there's, from what I understand, there is more ambiguity in the book whether the violence is real or not.
Well, that's kind of, I was going to get into that, but that's one of the, to me, that's the most interesting thing about American Psycho is throughout the entire film, you kind of believe that it's stylized, but it's actually happening.
Yes.
People are just aren't noticing that, he's killing these people at night. He's killing these women. He's killing these homeless people.
Right.
But near the end of the film, he escalates and gets into like a shootout with the cops.
Mm-hmm.
And he confesses to his lawyer about what he's done in a phone message.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets up the next day to go kind of deal with what's happened. He's thinking he's going to be arrested and all this stuff. And he goes to basically clean up his crime scenes, and they're not there.
Mm-hmm.
And he runs into his lawyer, and his lawyer thinks it's all a big joke. And his lawyer goes, "That was so funny. Like I could ever believe that Patrick Bateman would ever kill people." And he's talking to Patrick Bateman, and he's like, and Patrick says to him, "I'm not joking. I'm Patrick Bateman. It's mm-hmm. me, and I did those things." He's like, his lawyer just doesn't believe. He's like, "No, you're not. Patrick Bateman is some other guy." And he points at some other guy in the room. He goes, "You actually believe that cowardly guy Bateman could actually kill anyone? Please."
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was gonna say, and the entire thing is kind of. Could it be in his head? Maybe it is. Maybe the world is so shallow around him that he's fully... Because the whole world he's in is very obsessed with the artifice and the front.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how they present themselves. And it's so shallow and superficial. Maybe just no one notices what's happening. Maybe the people who were working in his apartment wanted to sell that abandoned apartment and covered it up.
Yeah.
Or maybe he just imagined everything.
All right,
maybe none of it's real. Maybe it's all just a psychological escape. To me, that's what's fascinating about American Psycho, that whole puzzle idea of is it real, is it not? Because it really could be read either way pretty passionately.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like, Total Recall, sort of. Like, is some of those things like really happen, or did he all just imagine it in his head? I think if the director made... the kind of choice to make it as real as possible up until like the very end, which in the book apparently it's not like that. I haven't read the book, but that just no. But before we get too deep into it, this also has an all-star cast. William Dafoe is also in this movie. Jared Leto, Reese Witherspoon,
and Justin Theroux's in
Justin
it.
Bill Sage, yeah. Matt Ross, Samantha Mathis.
Yeah, Samantha Mathis is in it. Yeah, it's got a lot of people, and it's very well cast.
Yes.
But it really is the Christian Bale show, because,
yeah.
God, what a great performance.
Yeah, it's really a breakout performance from Christian Bale, where he was, you know, kind of a supporting character and to a main role character. Not to mention... that he's Welsh and, you know, very much appears as very American. And yeah, it is sort of this like, it's very, let's just also mention, if you've not seen this movie, it's very, it's satire. Okay. The whole thing I think is very, you know, sort of satire and it's very sort of like this, I don't know, sort of like grotesque view of the excesses of the 80s, like how, you know, obsessed with looks and how obsessed the main character Patrick Bateman is on the way he's presented to other people, the way, you know, just his whole narcissistic personality, you know, from start to finish is very much like in excess to where it basically it really consumes him. And there's evidence of this that you see in the movie, like where there's this real obsession over all the different characters, like business cards. even though to us they would probably all look the same. They're white with gold lettering, right?
And they pretty much do all look the same.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's the entire gag. It's that they literally don't look any different, but they're like, oh my god, it's bone with embossed lettering.
Yeah, ooh. I've got raised lettering with off white, you know, or eggshell or what, you know, whatever. Yeah. Yeah. When they all say their name and vice president, you know, like
and they're all vice presidents. That's another really subtle joke in it, is that they're all they all have the title of vice president.
Well, and how off putting that, like, Christian Bale or Patrick Bateman, really, I should say, is put off by, you know, well, so-and-so liked his card better, or I keep getting mistaken for this other guy, you know, like, and that just goes to show, like, that is, to me, kind of a commentary of, like, first off, all these yuppies kind of look the same, right? Mm-hmm. They go to the same barber, they have the same clothes, you know, this, like, kind of uniformity that a lot of people, you know, have that we think about these kind of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
They all look the same. They all get their clothes from the same place. They all get their glasses from the same place.
Yeah.
And then,
it's all very expensive stuff, but it's all uniform.
Right. It's, yeah.
And that goes back to the idea of the two different interpretations of, is it real? Is it fantasy? Because maybe he is just this kind of faceless, you know, corporate guy. And this whole fantasy of killing people, of being like this alpha predator, is just his way of coping with the misery he feels from being basically a very successful nobody.
Right. Like, yeah, like his girlfriend, it's played by Reese Witherspoon, Evelyn, you know, asks him, like, you don't have to go to work. Why do you work? And he's like, because I have to fit in. You know, it's like,
yeah,
he's got to have this outward sort of appearance to himself, to everybody, and that sort of thing. And then, but he also winds up, like, taking, you know, like, he kills like a homeless guy, because it's like he takes it out on him, because he's like, you're not even trying to do anything, you know what I mean? Like, you're kind of worthless, and, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. It's like
to him, he wants to matter so bad,
right?
You know, and maybe the killing is, maybe the idea of saying he has to fit in means he has to cover up his sadistic tendencies, or maybe he just feels like he needs to be someone.
Yeah.
And maybe it's all just an internal thing of him just basically trying to cope with the fact that he's no one. And I think that's kind of at the end of the movie, when he goes to the realization that no one's gonna stop his homicidal ways. And he has this little monologue at the end where he talks about how empty he feels inside, how nothing matters. And there's a line in there, and he goes, this confession means nothing.
Yeah.
And I think what he's saying, that could go either way. Either he's gone past the point where he can be this alpha predator and just do what he wants, and he's realized he's beyond morality. Or it could mean that he's basically trapped in his own vapid existence, and no matter what he does, he can't break free of it, even if he has a psychotic break.
I think that's, if you want to psychoanalyze it, I think the second one, you know, where he realizes that, like, you know, no matter what I do, I'm not going to be able to break out of it. Like, I'm going to be this external person, but kind of have this, like, internal, like, struggle going on within, and nothing is ever going to quest, you know, that thirst of that sort of thing. So it's kind of like, you know, like he's trapped in his own hell, basically, you know, kind of thing.
Yes.
Like, he has that realization. I mean, and I don't want to, like I said, I don't want to really ruin the ending for anybody. Because I know, like, I want to mention it. I'll just go ahead and mention it. Netflix actually just recently got in trouble for a promotion where they revealed, you know, sort of the ending of The Truman Show, which, yeah, you know, The Truman Show has been out for forever. You know, it's been out for almost as long as America's. I don't remember what year it came out, but yeah, some people were really mad. They're like, I've never seen it, and now you've just ruined the ending.
Well, you know, as it goes back to, here's how I personally feel about it. This movie's been out for 20 years. You had time to see it.
Yeah, it's true.
And if you're listening to this show, we tell people what's coming out.
Yeah.
They have time to watch it.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that just shows you what a great job I think that it was written, and a great job by the director, and a great performance by Christian Bale. Because look here, we're sitting here not really talking about all the rest of the stuff, like the scenery or the lines or like whatever. We're psychoanalyzing the character. We're really getting deep within like the movie itself.
Yeah, and everything about the production design, the way it's shot, is immaculate. It's a beautiful movie.
Yeah, everything really is. Yeah, very deliberate and
yeah, everything's so clean looking. Mm-hmm. Like every suit is crisp. Every wall is stark white. It's just, I mean, it's really a meticulous film. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about some of the more fun aspects of it. Yeah. One thing I really picked up on over the years, I watch this every few years, so I always find something new in it,
uh-huh.
and it gets funnier every time I see it.
I can see that. Because you really get sort of the satire and the sort of the ridiculousness of Patrick Bateman's character. You know?
Yeah, once you get past the shock of how violent it is, or how implied violent it is, you see how kind of silly it is, too.
Right.
Like, Patrick is such a vapid character. Like, when he talks about, I know you'll appreciate this, when he talks about music.
Yeah.
And he, especially, I'll bring up the scene where he talks about Genesis. Yes. There's so much about his character that is revealed when he talks about his opinions on Genesis.
Yes.
Now, bear with me for a second. He talks about how the early stuff, the Peter Gabriel stuff, didn't make any sense to him.
Mm-hmm.
But once Phil Collins joined the band, That's when they hit their stride.
Well,
Studio, Invisible Touch, and all that kind of stuff. But what that is, Peter Gabriel's stuff with Genesis was very artful and it had a real deeper context to it. And a lot of Phil Collins's Genesis work was way more commercial and not nearly as kind of deep and artful. So of course, this vapid cipher of a person wouldn't get early Genesis, but would really be into Studio.
Right, or really be into, Huey Lewis and the News. Like, him to be square.
Talking about the pleasures of conformity.
Yeah, and talk about what a pop song in the 80s, like, Hip to Be Square was, you know what I mean? It's like, to really, like, relish that song like it's some, like it's a Mozart piece or something like that. Like, just shows the shallowness of the character. But I agree with you on Genesis. And not to be a snooty snoot, but I have to correct you there. Phil Collins was always in Genesis just as a drummer. He stepped forward as the lead singer.
You're right. My bad, man. Yes. You're totally right. I knew that.
Yes. Wind and Wuthering was the first Genesis album that featured Phil Collins' own vocal. And that's an interesting story, too, because I've read Phil Collins' book, but I won't go into it. But yeah, that whole idea, I love how the character talks about music in that sort of way, in that sort of like really deep way, like right before he, you know, does something crazy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, what he's saying is never actually that deep. He's always talking about how something is very commercial.
Yeah.
And like when he talks about how much he likes Whitney Houston, that's another thing that just cracks me up. When he tells him, when he's getting all emotional about Whitney Houston, and the girl just laughs at him.
Yeah.
She's like, you own a Whitney Houston CD?
Yeah.
It just, I don't know, it amuses me every time.
Yeah, it's almost like talking about, you know, Coke like it's a fine wine or something like that. Yeah,
that's exactly it.
Yeah.
He's so obsessed with what's popular. That's all he can think about, really. Patrick Bateman is not deep. Patrick Bateman is basically, all he is artifice. And I think that's part of where his misery comes from, is that he has nothing deeper in his life. Mm-hmm. He has no deeper connections. He doesn't know how to have them. And it makes him miserable.
I see. Yeah. I can get that. I do love how his character is always like, whenever he's trying to get out of a situation, he has to return some videotapes.
Oh, yeah, he gets uncomfortable too. Like, yeah, he gets, I love that. That's such a, to me, that I guess that makes it truly a video culture staple, because that is his default excuse. I've got to return some videotapes.
Well, I mean, the movie is supposed to take place between like late 1986 and like early 1987, so that would put it square in the middle of the the VHS era.
And you do see him watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre on videotape.
Yeah. And he also mentions at one time, he has a lunch date with Cliff Huxtable, which is Bill Cosby's character on the Cosby Show.
Yeah. Cause of course he would like sitcoms too. Cause sitcoms are popular.
Yeah. Like the most popular sitcom of the '80s. You know what I mean? Like Cliff, you know, I love how the detective Donald Kimball, like, doesn't even miss a beat. Like, he doesn't even know who Cliff Huxtable is. He thinks, you know, he didn't even question it. You know what I mean?
I think he's just so used to dealing with vapid stockbrokers all day long that it doesn't even register that it's weird to him.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real joy to watch Willem Dafoe and Christian Bale kind of bounce off each other.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick Bateman's vapidness and his reaction to other people. It's part of the best comedy in the entire movie to me. Like when he breaks up with Reese Witherspoon's character at the end, mm-hmm. and she's like near tears, and he's like, "I'm sorry, you're just not that important to me." For some reason, that makes me laugh so hard. Mm-hmm. I can't even really explain why I find it so funny, but it tickles me so much.
Right. Well, I mean, and then he talks to her like she's a child or something like that. Like, basically, stop it. You know, if you want to keep it, then you gotta keep quiet or whatever. Be quiet. I'm like, I say that to my kids when they start acting up. So,
But yeah, and we'd be remiss if we don't talk about the iconic scene where he kills Jared Leto's character while playing Hip to Be Square.
Yeah, doing a moon dance.
Yeah, doing the moon. Well, he does a little shimmy in the rain. He does that little ridiculous shimmy in the raincoat.
Yeah,
there's usually 1,000 GIFs of that on the internet. It is so funny.
Oh yeah,
like it makes me laugh so much every time.
Oh yeah, and to see him do, or not the moon dance, the moon walk. Excuse my 80s vernacular there.
Well, you know, the moonwalk is a dance, so I was going to let it slide and not correct you.
Yeah, but I mean, who talks about the moonwalk, you know, in the 2020? But yeah, it is really, very, very iconic there. And I wonder what Jared Leto thinks about that, you know, like now, like being a part of that scene. Because he's really only in like two scenes in the whole movie, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
It was very early in his acting career. He had just done Fight Club before that. Like, it was very early in his career before he became like, you know, a name.
Right.
But it's such a great scene. Like, it's the costuming is great. Like Bateman's weird like clear raincoat,
mm-hmm.
And like I say again, the way it's kind of framed, mm-hmm. the moonwalk was actually, from what I understand, was actually improvised. Like, it wasn't actually in the script where he hides the axe.
That's correct. It was improvised, and apparently, because apparently, like Mary Harron is very like controlling of the set. Like, there's no improv or all that kind of stuff. Like, you do it kind of how it is or whatnot. And so, there's only like two unscripted things in the movie, and the moonwalk was one of them.
Yeah, and it's so well staged, and it's the perfect blend of like a little bit violent and a little bit funny. Because as he's axing, you know, Paul Allen, Jared Leto's character, to death, he's like, "Try to get a reservation at Dorsia now, you know, like he's not even raging in a way that seems overly masculine. He's complaining about not being able to get reservations at a nice restaurant, you know."
Yeah. I
find them to be so damn funny. I can't stress that enough.
That doesn't surprise me. And I think that you kind of have to have that sick and twisted humor. And also, you know, to kind of enjoy it in that way. Like you said, like, once you kind of get over the kind of shock of like what happens and just kind of enjoy it for what it is and like the character for who he is, I think that it can be because it is satire. It isn't like, you know, like laugh out loud, but it is, you may laugh out loud, but I think it is kind of, you know, very like sort of tongue in cheek in that way.
Well, yeah, and it's not just Bateman; it's even the other characters too. Like, there's that scene where he's doing coke in the bathroom with Justin Theroux's character.
Yeah,
and Justin Theroux like rages for a second, and he's like, "Sorry, bro, steroids." That's funny. I mean, that is legitimately funny.
That's right. Well, I just thought it was funny the other guy that was in the next stall over. He's like, keep it down. I'm trying to do drugs over here.
It's full of subtly of things that are meant to be subtly funny. Like, you don't necessarily get that they're funny at first, but when you watch it again or think about it, like, oh yeah, that's pretty damn funny. And the movie, like, or the scene where he's about to kill the one guy whose business card is better than his, and it turns out that character is gay and thinks Patrick is hitting on him. And right. Patrick's immediate revulsion at the idea that this man could be attracted to him, and he starts, like, washing his gloved hands frantically.
Yeah, and he's, like, trying to get out of there, like, oh, okay, this is not what I thought it was. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's like, I've got to return some videotapes.
Yeah, that was another one of those lines. Oh, yeah. Goodness. Oh, gosh. Anyway, is there any scenes that you would want to fast forward through?
You know, I watched again for this, and I really think the movie is genius at this point. I've seen it 4 or 5 times since it came out, every few years, and I think at this point, it's damn near a masterpiece to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's so good at what it's trying to be. So no, I wouldn't fast forward through any of it. Now the scene that I love the most is really the very end of the movie where it goes into where he's trying to confess and no one believes him, and he has the moment where you really start to see that he's an unreliable narrator, and he has this little monologue at the end where he just zones in on his face. It's such an excellent scene, and it's such an amazing monologue. It's such an amazing piece of writing. I love it so much.
Yeah, I think that, you follow the character. You just follow, Christian Bale's character throughout the whole thing, alongside him, Patrick Bateman. And I have to agree with you. I think that if you take anything out, it sort of takes away from the storyline. I think it's very efficient in the way that it's told, although there are some scenes that it may not be, the pacing is kind of slow, but you still kind of get it and enjoy it. It's really only slow because it's like, it's kind of tense. And so, in that sense, I don't think that there's anything, and I really think that the some of the violence is grotesque, but there's just, like, to me, it's just like, there is a scene where he killed, where you actually get to see him, shoot people or see him stab people, and that's really, like, hard to watch. But any of the characters that he knows, like, there's no sort of premeditation, and all you see is, like, blood splatter, you know what I mean? Like, maybe a body laying there or something like that. It doesn't really... like grotesque in that way, I guess.
Yeah, it's very intentional choices for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So. And then, I didn't answer the question. What scene would I savor? One of my favorite scenes is the confession scene where he's like in his office and he like breaks down.
Oh yeah, and he's like sobbing and he's sobbing. Like, I ate some of their brains.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean that. I think. To me, is where you really get to see the inside of the character,
yeah,
and where he like really kind of comes where that facade is like really like kind of broken down, and you get to like the real essence, of him where it becomes like really vulnerable or whatever. Even though that there's a lot to enjoy about his excesses on the outside, but to me, I thought that performance, especially from Christian Bale, was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's really remarkable. I mean, every time I watch it, I'm just I totally get why he became a big star after that.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so let's get into the notes here. Got a lot of notes. Wall Street. The first draft from the writer, which I'll have to who wrote Wall Street? What's his name? Stanley Weiser and Oliver Stone. Stanley Weiser's first draft was initially called Greed. Very fitting.
Which I think would probably be a better title.
Yeah, but I think that I don't know. I mean, you could call it Greed, but I think that they don't... I don't know if they wanted to define it, you know what I mean? Just in the movie title, I guess you would say. Yeah. The studio wanted, which was 20th Century Fox... they really wanted, which I think 20th Century Fox did both these movies. I'm not really sure.
Lionsgate did.
Okay. The studio wanted Warren Beatty to play Gecko, but Beatty was uninterested, thankfully. And Stone, Oliver Stone, he wanted Richard Gere, but Richard Gere also said, I don't think so. Which also was also great because I think, you know, Gere probably saw, yeah, this guy's really nasty. I don't want to play a nasty character. However, Michael Douglas just came off of roles like Romancing the Stone, and he was looking for more edgy roles. So he actually shot this movie and Fatal Attraction like simultaneously. So he would like 1 week he would do Wall Street, and then like the next week he would do Fatal Attraction.
Yeah, and these are big movies for him. He was a big star at this time.
Yeah. Oliver Stone also met with Tom Cruise for the role of Bud Fox, but ultimately decided on Charlie Sheen, and liked Charlie Sheen's stiffness to Sheen's acting style to convey Bud's naivete.
Yeah, I definitely think it works in. I think it works in favor of the film for sure.
Oliver Stone gave Sheen the choice of Jack Lemmon or Martin Sheen to play Bud's father.
I think Jack Lemmon would have been a little too on the nose.
Yeah,
with Death of a Salesman and all that. So yeah, or Glengarry, eventually doing Glengarry Glen Ross. I think to me, Jack Lemmon is almost too decent. He has no edge to him.
Yeah, I don't think he could play like a blue collar character like Martin Sheen does.
Yeah.
Also,
Martin Sheen has a toughness to him.
Yeah. And before we move off Martin Sheen, I just want to say I'm so glad that that Oliver Stone chose to show his like coat putting on technique where he like flies it around his shoulders or whatever. Yeah. So great. Yeah. So great. I love it because I'm a big fan of The West Wing.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
So I think it was in his contract. He had to do it like on every episode. Daryl Hannah almost got fired as Sean Young did not get along with her. Well, Sean Young didn't get along with Charlie Sheen either, but apparently she really tried to get her roles swapped with Daryl Hannah. So because Daryl Hannah's character was so much bigger, and even the crew didn't get along with Daryl Hannah either, and they all thought it was a mistake. And, he was just like, no, I'll make it work. And he made it work as best as he could. There you go. And then Stone wanted to shoot in New York City, but the budget did not allow for it. So parts of the film were shot in Snowbird, Utah.
Which you never know. I mean, it really completely feels like a New York film.
Yeah.
The entire time.
Yeah. It was the first feature film to use a cordless mobile cellular telephone. So that scene on the beach, that's the first time like in a feature film you'd see one of those big Motorola brick phones.
Those ridiculous phones, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, some people will call it the Zach Morris phone.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Michael Douglas did win an Academy Award for Best Actor for this.
He's really good in it, yeah, He's really, really good.
Yeah, and this also, this is like a really breakout role for Michael Douglas. So where he really, he was already starring in roles, but this is where he really started getting like the big roles,
Yeah, like he was a big actor before, but he became a superstar because of this movie.
Yeah. Daryl Hannah won a Razzie Award for Worst Actor. So
yeah. It's not that she's bad. It's just, I don't know. The character's not that well written.
No.
Yeah, she's not the kind of actress who can really elevate material,
No, and very sort of like two-dimensional. Very sort of like one-dimensional almost.
Yeah.
So it was the only, but given the fact that you have an actor won, you have Academy Award and a Razzie, it's the only film to date to win an Oscar and a Razzie. Not just that's nominated, but to win in a category.
Well, that's a pretty cool piece of trivia right there.
Yeah. The soundtrack for Wall Street was done by Stuart Copeland, the drummer for The Police.
I thought that was the Stuart Copeland.
The Stuart Copeland. The budget was $16.5 million, and the box office take was $41 million. So kind of a big hit as they say. Roger Ebert gave it 3.5 stars out of 4.
That's fair. I mean, it's a well-made film.
Yeah. He says, all the financial wheeling and dealing seem complicated and convincing, and yet always have it make sense. The movie can be followed by anybody because the details of stock manipulation are all filtered through transparent layers of greed. Most of the time, we know what's going on. All of the time, we know why.
That's an excellent point, that it does take very complicated concepts and really distills them in a way that you can follow.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. And the Rotten Tomatoes critic score, 78%. The audience score, 81%. So pretty
even there.
Yeah, pretty agreeable. And I'd have to go with that. I think that's a pretty fair point there. And in 2010, Michael Douglas would reprise his role as Gordon Gekko, as he is recently released from prison in Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps. It was also directed by Oliver Stone and revolves around the 2008 financial crisis. Charlie Sheen appears as Bud Fox, but only in a cameo role. It also stars Shia LaBeouf and Josh Brolin, but that only has a 55% Rotten Tomatoes critic score and a 44% audience score.
Yeah, I'm thinking about watching it now that I've seen the first one all the way through. I'm curious to watch it, but I don't know if I'll get around to it anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't know how great it is. I mean, I know it's still Oliver Stone, but I just don't know if he has with a score like that in Rotten Tomato. I have to think. I don't know.
Yeah, it gives you pause for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get to American Psycho. So this one had a very interesting sort of take on how it got made. Usually on my notes, I usually don't spend a lot of time. Sometimes I talk about how a script got from one side to the other, and how it actually got greenlit and got made. But this has a really interesting history, and I think that it kind of demonstrates how sort of split and how sort of dangerous this type of movie is. Okay, so the producer Edward R. Pressman bought the rights to the novel American Psycho in 1992, with Johnny Depp expressing an interest in the lead role. David Cronenberg then became attached to the project, but eventually, years went on. Pressman became bored with the project, and in 1996, he was looking for another buyer. So, but in steps in Mary Harron, and she says, well, why don't I direct it? Since, you don't have David Cronenberg, but I can direct it. So then she stepped in with co-writer, Genevieve Turner, and, they were really influenced by the film Hatched for the Honeymoon. Are you familiar with that movie at all?
I'm not. I'll check it out after this though.
Okay. Harron had verbal agreements at that time. This is 1997, I think. So this is 3 years even before, and got verbal agreements from Christian Bale, William Dafoe, and Jared Leto that said, yeah, if you're going to direct it, we're going to do it. I'm in. I mean, that's pretty awesome for a director to just call up people and say, yeah, I think it'd be great for this. And they trust the director and go, okay.
Yeah.
By 1997, Lionsgate finally greenlit and got the funding for it. And then they wanted Edward Norton or Leonardo DiCaprio to play the lead role.
And I just can't. I've actually heard that before. I've heard that part before, and I just can't imagine either of them in the role. I really can't.
Now, here's where the two movies of Wall Street and American Psycho sort of cross paths. The Lionsgate also, or no, they got DiCaprio. He was really interested. And so he talked to Lionsgate, was like, well, let's, maybe if we can get Oliver Stone or Danny Boyle or Martin Scorsese to direct it. So they call up Oliver Stone, and Oliver Stone's like, yeah, that sounds interesting. And then he's even quoted it saying that Mary Harron was probably the single worst person to do this movie.
Yeah, I often wonder if that was a little bit of misogyny on their part, since she was a female director. I don't know. I mean, because I mean, she's very talented, and I don't know why he would say that.
I mean, either that, or he's just trying to posturize so that it would make it better for him to get the movie because he really wanted it. You know what I mean? So you're just gonna throw somebody under the bus. Anyway, Stone wanted to take the satire completely out of it, and ultimately DiCaprio and Stone disagreed, like on the this whatever new script that Stone came up with, and DiCaprio wound up doing The Beach instead.
Because really, the satire is the entire point.
Yeah. So then Lionsgate said, "Okay, well, if we can't get DiCaprio, let's get Edward Norton." So, but, like apparently Christian Bale. Like, you know, said, "I know they're going to want you to do it, but please turn it down because I want it really bad." And Edward Norton did. He actually turned it down, you know, at Bale's request.
Well, that's very noble of him.
Well, yeah, because I think it's really like a, you know, like if you think of the roles of Edward Norton, it very much fits within his repertoire, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, Bale, being a, he was committed, so he turned down other movie roles and auditions for 9 months just to do this movie. He was influenced by Tom Cruise's energy and intense friendliness with nothing behind the eyes. And this is after seeing Tom Cruise in an interview on Late Night with David Letterman.
That's a pretty mean thing to say, but I get it.
Yeah. Bale also says he used, and you'll appreciate this, he used Nicolas Cage's performance in Vampire's Kiss as an inspiration for this role.
I could see it, because Nicolas Cage plays a very kind of similar kind of vapid idiot in Vampire's Kiss, yeah.
I have not seen that movie.
It's the one that has all of the Cage like reaction memes.
Okay.
Like the O'Reilly meme and all that.
Oh, okay.
All that comes from Vampire's Kiss. It's basically about a guy who thinks he's been turned into a vampire, and it's full of so many highlights of whenever people talk about Cage overacting, that's the movie they always kind of point to as him being a bad actor. He's all over the place in it, but it's worth watching. But we're not here to talk about that.
All right. Apparently, Christian Bale was a method actor. You know, he's very much in this, you know, the method acting, like you become the character, right? So he followed Bateman's routine in the morning, every morning.
Yeah. I gotta say, man, Christian Bale in this thing looks statuesque throughout the entire thing.
It does.
It's ridiculous. How good he looks in this film.
Well, they did such a good job on the makeup. I don't know if you've noticed, and I noticed this, but going on, because he mentioned something about like getting bags under his eyes and wearing that like cold pack in the morning or whatever. But like as the movie goes on, you see his bags get heavier and heavier. So it's almost like you get the idea that he's not following, you know, he's getting so psychotic, he's not following his routine as closely as he should. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's like another subtle hit. Hint.
The movie is very detailed like that. That's why it's a movie to me that really rewards rewatching every few years, because you notice all kinds of things about it.
Mm-hmm. Bale also spoke with an American accent on and off set all times. Many of the crew thought he was preparing for another role when he spoke in his native Welsh accent at the rap party.
Yeah, it always surprises me to hear his real voice,
because
he rarely uses it even in interviews. Like when he normally does like press for films, he'll use whatever voice he was using in the movie. It's really rare to see him talk in his normal like Welsh accent. He's got a lovely accent. You just never hear it.
I've heard it a few times when he's done, like shows or just like off, you know, interviews that are not associated with the movie.
Yeah. You know, he's calmed down a little bit since he's won an Oscar. He's loosened up a little bit, but before that he was very, very serious about that kind of stuff. And he's mellowed out in his old age after being super successful.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know this either about this movie, but, apparently, Mary Harron asked William Dafoe to portray his character, Detective Donald Kimble, in three different ways. So she did three takes, one where he knew Patrick Bateman killed Paul Allen, one where he didn't know that Bateman killed Paul Allen and one where he wasn't sure. So he did like one take where he like knew, one where he didn't know, and one where he wasn't sure. And then Heron then edited the takes together to throw the audience off to what Kimball was thinking.
Yeah, and you never really know. It's one thing. It's one of the things I really like about Defoe's performance is it really, you have no idea what he's actually thinking at any point in his scenes.
Yeah.
Like sometimes he,
go ahead.
And you don't notice that it's been manipulated that way. It just feels natural, and it's interesting.
You know, I didn't feel like it was natural because I couldn't figure him out. So I thought it was like a slight to Defoe because I'm like, this performance isn't really consistent. You know what I mean? So I was just like, I was kind of thrown off by it, but that's because I'm just familiar with Defoe's work and like how he works. But really, if you just look at it and not as just like he's Willem Dafoe, you just look at it as like just as, you know, the character that he plays on screen, right? Just how he reacts. Then you totally get it. Then you're like, oh, okay, I see, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really interesting. So yeah, I thought that was really cool. I thought that was very, very different. And I think that's, you know, kind of the thing that you get with a good director is by doing things in a slightly different way, but like really, you know, making it work.
Well, and just really going for, like, really knowing what she was doing, what she wanted, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, she had a very clarity of what she wanted it to be and made it happen. Like the movie is filled with just bold decisions.
Right. Although most of the dialogue in the movie is taken word for word from the novel, there is, you know, a lot of differences between the novel and the movie. The novel's a lot more grotesque. There's a few more characters. And like I mentioned before, it's also very, a lot more ambiguous as to if the killing or the violence is going on in Bateman's mind or if it's actually really happening. Although the setting, once again, setting is in New York City, but this was filmed in Toronto, Canada, which makes more sense because that's where, you know, Lionsgate is. Their headquarters.
Yeah.
And
it's a little more clear that it's not New York in this because it's very stylized. It doesn't feel like it's too clean to be New York.
It is very clean. Okay, so the stereo, I have to talk audio nerd, okay?
Okay.
The stereo system, because there's forums that have like people have asked like what stereo equipment that he had, okay? So if you want to go down that route, it is an 80s era Harman Kardon system. So it is a HK725 preamp, an HK770 amplifier, an HK EQ7 equalizer, and an HK440XM cassette deck. The piece of black equipment that's in there that you'll see is a Pioneer PD4300 CD player. And the speakers are KEF 104/2 speakers. So, I mean, KEF or KEF, some people call it. It's a British manufacturer of speakers, makes very high-end speakers. And 104/2s were their, like, top-of-the-line speakers. All the HK, like, 7 series were, like, their top-of-the-line Harman Kardon stuff. So That just, you know, is a point to, you know, his, you know, sort of Bateman's character that he's, you know, like he has to have like the best of the best. Like nobody's going to have anything like better than him sort of thing.
It goes back to everything about the movie is so meticulous. That's one thing I really love about it, you know. Everything has so much thought in it.
Right. I actually have some KEF speakers of my own from that same era. They're not 104-2 or /2s, but they're very sort of similar. Designed by Andrew Jones. Anyway, so although Huey Lewis and the new song "Hip to Be Square" appeals in the film, it is not included on the soundtrack. It was initially included, however, Huey Lewis's management decided not to give the soundtrack clearance due to the violent nature of the film. So 100,000 copies of the album had to be recalled and destroyed. Although in 2013, in an interview with Rolling Stone, Huey Lewis denies these claims and said that Lewis states that the management like purely just made it up. That he, you know, that they said, you know, because the management said, you know, well, Huey said it was too violent.
But yeah, well, and I think I believe Huey there, because you know he did do that parody video of it with Weird Al Yankovic years later, where they reenact the scene together.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that Huey is okay with it, and how can he not be? I mean, his music's in a very iconic scene in cinema now.
Right.
I mean, that scene will far outlive all of us, really.
Yeah, I think management more had a beef with. They weren't like notified that it was going to be on the soundtrack. So they're like flexing their management muscle and like, no, take it off. Well, it's too violent. You know, so I think it's like one of those things where management really kind of like made a decision to pull it. You know what I mean? So even though that if it was included on the soundtrack, like they're going to reap those royalties on it. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
From the album sales, Whitney Houston denied being included in the film at all for The Greatest Love of All, and in the movie is just a easy listening orchestrated instrumental version.
I'm going to go ahead and throw some shade and say I can never tell the difference. I thought it actually was the Whitney Houston song.
Well, it's because I think they use the same sort of background music, like the instrumental version that's very similar. So you never hear Whitney like singing. So it just seems like it's the song, or maybe they had another singer for the movie. I don't know. So, it initially was rated NC-17 due to Bateman having a threesome with two prostitutes. So producers cut 18 seconds of that particular footage to obtain a rated R rating.
And now it's pretty much impossible to see the rated R version. Most versions of it are the unrated version.
Yeah. If you get the Blu-ray that was released in 2007, you're going to see the uncut version.
Yeah.
In the book, Bateman... Oh, I should have put this earlier. But in the book, I mentioned all the Harman Kardon equipment. Sorry. In the book, Bateman had a Sansui system, which Sansui would have been a much... they were a very hi-fi company in the 70s and early 80s. But by the late 80s, they were more... Like, I think they got bought out by the Sharp Corporation, so they weren't as high-end stuff.
Yeah, it goes back to the author not necessarily knowing as much about it as a production designer.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, yeah, so I thought that was cool. Where was I at? Oh, the budget was $7 million, and it grossed $34.3 million. I mean, that's...
It was surprisingly successful.
The biggest... I mean, and in that budget of $7 million... The biggest expense was the rights to the music.
Makes sense.
Because there's a lot of needle drops in that movie. I mean, seriously. I mean, popular songs. So Roger Ebert gave it 3 stars and regarded Christian Bale as being, quote, heroic in the way that he allows the character to leap joyfully into despicability. There is no instinct for self-preservation here, and that is one mark of a good actor. And I'm sorry, Roger Ebert does not write in the way that speaks well, I guess you would say.
Well, what he's basically saying there is it's a fearless performance. That Bale was unafraid to be nasty in the film. Like, he's not concerned with his own image as an actor. He just did what was right for the role.
Yep. Rotten Tomatoes, critics 69%, audience 85%.
It's definitely a movie that's gotten more popular and more well-regarded over the years.
Yeah, I think that, and I think that the throwback to the 80s and that culture and like the music and stuff like that is also kind of, really kind of just a calling back to that sort of era as well. In 2002... a direct-to-video sequel was released called American Psycho 2 that was directed by Morgan J. Freeman. No, not that Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, it stars Mila Kunis from that 70s show.
Yes, stars Mila Kunis. Yeah, go ahead.
It's some trash, yeah.
The sequel's only connection with the original is the death of Bateman as a quick flashback. Kunis actually stated in 2005 that it was a different project when she did the film, and it was not supposed to be a sequel, and was basically re-edited to be a sequel, and she was not very happy with it.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible. Now, the character has appeared in other books by the author, so if you guys ever want to read the book, he does reappear in some of Easton Ellis's other writing. But yeah, there's never been a true American Psycho sequel.
Yeah, in 2013, it was announced that FX and Lionsgate were developing an American Psycho television series that would serve as a sequel that was set in present with Bateman in his 50s. But as of 2019, that project has presumed to be canceled because nothing ever has come of it.
And not to go into too far into recommendations already, but if you're interested in that kind of, if that idea sounds really appealing to you, then I highly recommend Hannibal on Netflix.
Okay.
Which is basically a reimagining of the Hannibal Lecter movies as a prestige TV series. And it's very much in the same kind of beautiful artistic aesthetic of American Psycho. So it has a lot of the idea of an older serial killer. It's really good. Mm-hmm. So if the idea of an aging serial killer in the Patrick Bateman vein is sounding interesting to you, mm-hmm. then I recommend checking out Hannibal on Netflix. It's a great series.
Yeah, where basically the protagonist is kind of the antagonist or whatever you call it.
Exactly, yeah.
Or what do they call it? The anti-hero or whatever that it is?
Yes, anti-hero,
yes. Yeah. All right. So, getting into recommendations,
we got to do the question we always do on the show.
Oh.
If you were to rent this from the video store, would you return Wall Street on time or would you keep it an extra day?
That's a good question. It's one of those that I don't really want to see all the time, I guess. I'd probably return it.
Me too. I enjoyed it. I don't really have any desire to watch it again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad I watched it. I'm glad I had the experience, but I would get it back on time.
Yep.
What about American Psycho?
American Psycho, okay, here's where I'm kind of split. I would probably keep it, but I don't know. You'd have to be in the right mood to watch it, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's fair. That's why I mentioned before, in the 20 years since it's been out, I've watched it 5 times. That's like, and if you do the math, that means every, 3 or 4 years or so.
Yeah.
So you need some distance for it. Yeah. But yeah, I feel the same way. I would keep it an extra day. I own the movie. I think it's great. The more I watch it, the more I've grown to love it.
Yeah, if you can sit there and go, I really want to sit and appreciate this or whatever. That would be the case. But I mean, it can be a little bit of a weird, sort of downer because, let's face it, there's death and violence, and it is weird and awkward at times, and so it can be.
And I will say the violence and stuff kind of fades into the background the more you watch it. Like it becomes less like jarring.
It's still awkward though. It's still just I still think it's not a movie you just sit down with some popcorn and enjoy. You know what I mean?
Fair enough. But I'm also the guy who has I'm right now, and I'm looking at a signed Texas Chainsaw Massacre poster above my desk right now. So we are very different people, Ryan. So,
yes, very much so. I'm a little bit on the lighter side. You're a little bit of the darker side. That's fine.
Yeah, which is why we work so well together on this show. But let's move on to recommendations. Do you have any recommendations?
I already mentioned a couple, like Secret of My Success and Working Girl, but I think the one that I am going to, and I hope it's not the same one that you're going to suggest, but it's probably not, is a movie that also came out in 2000 called Boiler Room.
That's an excellent choice.
Yeah, starring Giovanni Ribisi and Vin Diesel. It also is kind of like this, scheme. It turns out that it's just sort of like junk bond scheme, but it is sort of like this, it kind of contains both elements of we're going to get rich quick and also like picking ourselves up by the bootstrap and like doing the right thing and not doing, so some illegal like SEC activity going on and but there's a little bit of that, like, you know, coffee, you know, coffee is for closers kind of thing, you know what I mean, where it's like the bootstraps and that you know, kind of Glengarry Glen Ross thing happening. So and it's a really, like, fast pace you know, movie that's very sort of enjoyable, you know, and that was made, like I said, in the 2000s, and it's only, you know, it's 120 minutes long. It's also stars Ben Affleck.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a,
so. Yeah, that's my suggestion.
I think it's a very underappreciated movie. I think that's a good call. My suggestion is a movie that has elements of both films we talked about tonight, and it's kind of an obvious choice, but it fits too well. Because it deals a little bit with, like, stock trading and brokering and the whole greed above all mentality. But it's also a dark satire, and the movie I'm talking about is, of course, Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, which is based on a true story of a guy named Jordan Belfort who did go to jail for all kinds of, you know, corporate, you know, shenanigans. Mm-hmm. And it is a blistering satire of Wall Street, corporate greed, and, you know, it's just, it fits so well in with both films. Like, it really is kind of almost the bridge between the two films, where it's got the you know, the qualities and the technical knowledge of Wall Street with the dark, biting satire of American Psycho. Mm-hmm. I think they would make a great triple feature. And yes, I think Boiler Room would be a great movie to kind of round out an entire evening of, you know, corporate shitty people.
Yeah, like, I think we could probably do, you know, I think Wolf of Wall Street is a little bit too late within our, like, era, but Wolf of Wall Street and Boiler Room, you know, together would be, you know, kind of a good double feature as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, Wolf of Wall Street's a little too new for what we cover primarily on the show. But yeah, you're right. They would make a good double feature in themselves. But yeah, those four films together, that's a real interesting film festival right there, I think.
Yeah.
That's a good marathon.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. And if you were going to, you know, do kind of the lighter side of, you know, Wall Street, then, you know, there's always, you know, movies like Secret of My Success and Working Girl. If you want to exploit the lighter side.
That's true, though. You know, I'm not a fan of Working Girl, but I do like Secret. But I do like Secret of My Success.
Yeah, it's the more fun side of you know, the Wall Street kind of thing, and we'll definitely have to get into. I think it's a movie that we should cover at some point. Maybe next season.
We're gonna do some more Michael J. Fox. You know, because you know he's one of our deities here. Let's be honest.
Oh yeah.
But anyway, so speaking of lighter side, I think we're going to have to go much lighter on the next episode. I'm not going to say what it is, but it's going to be way more fun than, like, serial killers and, like, you know, corporate buyouts. But I had a lot of fun tonight, Ryan. Thanks for talking about these movies with me. Thanks for sitting through the violence that is American Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate you, you know, like, branching out and watching these things with me, my friend.
Oh, yeah. I completely enjoyed it. I've never actually watched American Psycho or Wall Street. I've seen probably parts of American Psycho because being in as much music as I love, like, you're subjected to those scenes where, you know, Christian Bale talks about Huey Lewis or Genesis in those awkward kind of ways. But yeah, I enjoyed both films. I think that they're very outstanding, and I think that, you know, they fit within, you know, the repertoire of cinema for sure. And so looking forward to next week. And, you know, if you guys have anything to add for American Psycho that maybe we missed and you want to, you know, psychoanalyze, you know, with us, then, you know, feel free to comment or, you know, tweet at us.
Yeah, by all means, let us know. Do you think it really happened? Is it all in his head? Is Michael Douglas a better actor than Martin Sheen? These are questions we want to know your thoughts on, so please reach out to us. You know, by all means, you know, subscribe, rate us on iTunes. We want to hear from you guys, whether you love us or hate us.
All right, well, that about does it. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Ryan Ankry.
And I'm Matthew Estreet. And oh yeah, I've got to go return some videotapes.
Yeah, let's go return those videotapes. At least Wall Street. Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, come hang out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
New card. What do you think?
Whoa. Very nice.
Patrick, you're so sweet.
Jean?
Yes, Patrick?
Would you like to accompany me to dinner?
Sabrina, why don't you dance a little? Christy, get down on your knees. We're not through yet.
That's a wonderful suit. It looks so soft.
I don't think I can control myself. If you stay, something bad will happen. I feel lethal, on the verge of frenzy. I think my mask of sanity is about to slip. Do you have any witnesses or fingerprints?
Actually, yes.
You're inhuman.
I know my behavior can be erratic sometimes.
Hey, Paul!
So, what do you do?
I'm into, murders and executions mostly. I have all the characteristics of a human being, but not a single clear, identifiable emotion. I simply am not there.
I just had to kill a lot of people!